pleasure, madame," he said, and bowed once more, making a much more elegant production of it. He straightened and stood, turning his hat in his hands, obviously trying to think what to say next. Jamie, standing bare-legged in his shirt alongside, glanced from me to Charles, seemingly at an equal loss for words. "Ah," I said, to break the silence, "have you had an accident, Your Highness?" I nodded at the handkerchief wrapped around his hand, and he glanced down as though noticing it for the first time.
"Yes," he said. No. I mean, it is nothing, my lady."
He flushed redder, staring at his hand. His manner was odd, something between embarrassment and anger. I could see the stain on the cloth spreading, though, and put my feet out of bed, groping for my dressing gown. "You'd better let me have a look at it," I said. The injury, exposed with some reluctance by the prince, wasn't serious, but it was unusual. "That looks like an animal bite," I said incredulously, dabbing at the small semicircle of puncture wounds in the webbing between thumb and forefinger. Prince Charles winced as I squeezed the flesh around it, meaning to cleanse the wound by bleeding before binding it.
"Yes," he said, "a monkey bite. Disgusting flea-ridden beast," he burst out. "I told her she must dispose of it. Undoubtedly the animal is diseased."
I had found my medicine box and now applied a thin layer of gentian ointment.
"I don't think you need worry," I said, intent on my work, "so long as it isn't rabid, that is." "Rabid?"
The prince went quite pale.
"Do you think it could be?"
Plainly he had no idea what rabid might mean, but wanted no part of it.
"Anything's possible," I said cheerfully.
Surprised by his sudden appearance, it was just beginning to dawn on me that it would save everyone a great deal of trouble in the long run if this young man would succumb gracefully to some quick and deadly disease. Still, I couldn't quite find it in my heart to wish him gangrene or rabies, and I tied up his hand neatly in a fresh linen bandage. He smiled, bowed again, and thanked me very prettily in a mixture of French and Italian. Still apologizing effusively for his untimely visit, he was towed away by Jamie, now respectably kilted, for a drink downstairs. Feeling the chill of the room seep through my gown and robe, I crawled back into bed and drew the quilts up under my chin. So this was Prince Charles.
Bonny enough, to be sure, at least to look at.
He seemed very young, much younger than Jamie, though I knew Jamie was only a year or two older. His Highness did have considerable charm of manner, though, and quite a bit of self-important dignity, despite his disordered dress. Was that really enough to take him to Scotland at the head of an army of restoration? As I drifted off, I wondered exactly what the heir to the throne of Scotland had been doing, wandering over the Paris rooftops in the middle of the night with a monkey bite on one hand. The question was still on my mind when Jamie woke me some time later by sliding into bed and planting his large, ice-cold feet directly behind my knees.
"Don't scream like that," he said. "You'll wake the servants."
"What in hell was Charles Stuart doing running about the rooftops with monkeys?" I demanded, taking evasive action. "Take those bloody ice cubes off me."
"Visiting his mistress," said Jamie succinctly. "All right, then, stop kicking me."
He removed the feet and embraced me, shivering, as I turned to him.
"He has a mistress? Who?"
Stimulated by whiffs of cold and scandal, I was quickly waking up.
"It's Louise de la Tour,"
Jamie explained reluctantly, in response to my prodding. His nose looked longer and sharper than usual, with the thick brows drawn together above it. Having a mistress was bad enough, in his Scottish Catholic view, but it was well known that royalty had certain privileges in this regard. The Princess Louise de la Tour was married, however, and, royalty or not, taking a married woman as one's mistress was positively immoral, his cousin Jared's example notwithstanding.
"Ha!" I said with satisfaction. I knew it. He says he's in love with her, he reported tersely, yanking the quilts up over his shoulders. He insists she loves him too. Says she's been faithful only to him for the last 3 months. Ah!
Well, it's been known to happen, I said, amused. So he was visiting her. How did he get out on the roof, though? Did he tell you that?
Oh, aye, he told me.
Charles, fortified against the night with several glasses of Jared's best aged port, had been quite forthcoming. The strength of true love had been tried severely this evening, according to Charles, by his inamorata's devotion to her pet, a rather ill-tempered monkey that reciprocated His Highness's dislike and had more concrete means of demonstrating its opinions. Stamping his fingers under the monkey's nose in derision, His Highness had suffered first a sharp bite in the hand, and then the sharper bite of his mistress's tongue exercised in bitter reproach. The couple had quarrelled hotly, to the point that Louise, Princesse de Rohan, had ordered Charles from her presence. He had expressed himself only too willing to go. Never, he emphasized dramatically, to return. The prince's departure, however, had been considerably hampered by the discovery that the princess's husband had returned early from his evening of gaming and was comfortably ensconced in the anteroom with a bottle of brandy.
So, said Jamie, smiling despite himself at the thought, he wouldn't have stayed with the lassie, but he couldn't go out the door. So he threw up the sash and jumped out on the roof. He got down almost to the street, he said, along the drainage pipes. But then the city guard came along, and he had to scramble back up to stay out of their sight. He had a rare time of it, he said, dodging about the chimneys and slipping on the wet slates, until it occurred to him that our house was only 3 houses down the row, and the rooftops close enough to hop them like lily pads.
I said, feeling warmth re-establish itself around my toes.
Did you send him home in the coach?
No, we took one of the horses from the stable.
If he's been drinking Jared's port, I hope they both make it to Montmartre, I remarked. It's a good long way.
Well, it will be a cold, wet journey, no doubt, said Jamie, with the smugness of a man virtuously tucked up in a warm bed with his lawfully wedded wife.
He blew out the candle and pulled me close against his chest, spoon-fashion.
"Serve him right," he murmured. "A man ought to be married."
The servants were up before dawn, polishing and cleaning in preparation for entertaining Monsieur Duveny at a small private supper in the evening. "I don't know why they bother," I told Jamie, lying in bed with my eyes closed, listening to the bustle downstairs. All they need do is dust off the chess set and put out a bottle of brandy. He won't notice anything else. He laughed and bent to kiss me goodbye.
That's all right. I'll need a good supper if I'm to go on beating him.
He patted my shoulder in farewell.
I'm going to the warehouse, Sassnach. I'll be home in time to dress, though.
In search of something to do that would take me out of the servants' way, I finally decided to have a footman escort me down to the Rohans. Perhaps Louise could use a bit of solace, I thought, after her quarrel of the night before. Vulgar curiosity, I told myself primly, had nothing whatsoever to do with it. When I returned in the late afternoon, I found Jamie slouched in a chair near the bedroom window with his feet propped on the table, collar undone, and hair rumpled as he pored over a sheaf of scribbled papers. He looked up at the sound of the door closing, and the absorbed expression melted into a broad grin.
"Sassnach, there you are!"
He swung his long legs down and came across to embrace me. He buried his face in my hair, nuzzling, then drew back and sneezed. He sneezed again, and let go of me to grope in his sleeve for the handkerchief he carried there, military style.
"What do you smell like, Sassnach?"
he demanded, pressing the linen square to his nose just in time to muffle the results of another explosive sneeze. I reached into the bosom of my dress and plucked the small sachet from between my breasts. Jasmine, roses, hyacinth, and lily of the valley.
Ragweed, too, apparently, I added, as he snorted and wheezed into the capacious depths of the handkerchief.
Are you all right? I looked around for some means of disposal, and settled for dropping the sachet into a stationery box on my desk at the far side of the room.
Aye, I'll do. It's the hi-ya-hi-ya-hi-choo!
Goodness! I hastily flung the window open and motioned to him. He obligingly stuck his head and shoulders out into the wet drizzle of the morning, breathing in gusts of fresh, hyacinth-free air.
Oh, that's better, he said with relief, pulling in his head a few minutes later.
His eyes widened.
What are you doing now, Sassenach?
Washing, I explained, struggling with the back laces of my gown. Or getting ready to, at least. I'm covered with oil of hyacinth, I explained, as he blinked. If I don't wash it off, you're liable to explode. He dabbed meditatively at his nose and nodded.
You've a point there, Sassenach. Shall I have the footman fetch up some hot water?
No, don't bother. A quick rinse should take most of it off, I assured him, unbuttoning and unlacing as quickly as possible. I raised my arms, reaching behind my head to gather my hair into a bun. Suddenly, Jamie leaned forward and grasped my wrist, pulling my arm into the air. What are you doing? I said, startled.
What have you done, Sassenach? He demanded.
He was staring under my arm.
Shaved, I said proudly.
Or rather, waxed. Louise had her servante aux petits soins, you know, her personal groomer, there this morning. And she did me, too.
Waxed?
Jamie looked rather wildly at the candlestick by the ewer, then back at me.
You put wax in your oxters.
Not that kind of wax, I assured him. Scented beeswax. The grooming lady heated it, then spread the warm wax on. Once it's cooled, you just jerk it off. I winced momentarily in recollection. And Bob's your uncle.
My uncle Bob wouldn't countenance any such goings-on, said Jamie severely. What in hell would you do that for?
He peered closely at the sight, still holding my wrist up.
Didn't it ha-ha-choof?
He dropped my hand and backed up rapidly.
Didn't it hurt?
He asked, handkerchief to nose once more. Well, a bit, I admitted.
Worth it, though, don't you think?
I asked, raising both hands like a ballerina and turning slightly to and fro. First time I felt entirely clean in months.
Worth it?
He said, sounding a little dazed.
What's it to do with clean that you've pulled all the hairs out from under your arms?
A little belatedly, I realized that none of the Scottish women I had encountered employed any form of depilation. Furthermore, Jamie had almost certainly never been in sufficiently close contact with an upper-class Parisienne to know that many of them did.
Well,
I said, suddenly realizing the difficulty an anthropologist faces in trying to interpret the more singular customs of a primitive tribe.
It smells much less, I offered.
And what's wrong with the way you smell? He said heatedly. At least you smelt like a woman, not a damn flower garden. What do you think I am, man or a bumblebee? Would you wash yourself, Sassenach, so I can get within less than 10 feet of you?
I picked up a cloth and began sponging my torso. Madame Le Serre, Louise's groomer, had applied scented oil all over my body. I rather hoped it would come off easily. It was disconcerting to have him hovering just outside sniffing range, glaring at me like a wolf circling its prey. I turned my back to dip the cloth into the bowl and said offhandedly over my shoulder, I did my legs, too. I stole a quick glance over my shoulder. The original shock was fading into a look of total bewilderment.
Your legs didn't smell like anything, he said, unless you've been walking knee-deep in the cow byre.
I turned around and pulled my skirt up to my knees, pointing one toe forward to display the delicate curves of calf and chin. "But they look so much nicer," I pointed out, "all nice and smooth, not like Harry the Hairy Ape." He glanced down at his own fuzzy knees, offended.
"An ape, am I?"
"Not you, me," I said, getting exasperated.
"My legs are any amount hairier than yours ever were."
"Well, they're supposed to be. You're a man." He drew in breath as though about to reply, then let it out again, shaking his head and muttering something to himself in Gaelic. He flung himself back into the chair and sat back, watching me through narrowed eyes, every now and then muttering to himself again. I decided not to ask for a translation. After most of my bath had been accomplished in what might best be described as a charged atmosphere, I decided to attempt conciliation. "It might have been worse, you know," I said, sponging the inside of one thigh. "Louise had all her body hair removed." That startled him back into English, at least temporarily.
"What? She's taken the hairs off her honey pot," he said,
horrified into uncharacteristic vulgarity. "Mm-hmm," I replied, pleased that this vision had at least distracted him from my own distressingly hairless condition. Every hair. Madame Lasserre plucked out the stray ones.
"Mary, Michael and Bride."
He closed his eyes tightly, either in avoidance or the better to contemplate the prospect I had described. Evidently the latter, for he opened his eyes again and glared at me, demanding,
"She's going about now bare as a wee lassie."
"She says," I replied delicately, "that men find it erotic." His eyebrows nearly met his hairline, a neat trick for someone with such a classically high brow.
"I do wish you'd stop that muttering," I remarked, hanging the cloth over a chair back to dry.
"I can't understand a word you say."
"On the whole, Sassenach," he replied, "that's as well."
Chapter 12. L'Hôpital des Anges.
"All right,"
Jamie said resignedly over breakfast. He pointed a spoon at me in warning.
"Go ahead, then. But you'll take Myrto as escort beside the footman. It's a poor neighbourhood near the cathedral."
"Escort?" I sat up straight, pushing back the bowl of porridge which I had been eyeing with something less than enthusiasm. "Jamie, do you mean you don't mind if I visit L'Hôpital des Anges?"
"I don't know if I mean that exactly,"
he said, spooning in his own porridge in a businesslike way.
"But I expect I'll mind a lot more if you don't. And if you work at the hôpital, at least it'll keep you from spending all your time with Louise de Rouen. I suppose there are worse things than associating with beggars and criminals,"
he said darkly.
"At least I don't expect you'll come home from a hospital with your privates plucked bare."
"I'll try not," I assured him. I had seen a number of good hospital matrons in my time, and a few of the really excellent ones who had exalted a job into a vocation. With Mother Hildegard, the process had been reversed, with impressive results. Hildegard de Gascogne was the most suitable person I could imagine to be in charge of a place like L'Hôpital des Anges. Nearly 6 feet tall, her gaunt, raw-boned frame swathed in yards of black wool, she loomed over her nursing sisters like a broomstick scarecrow guarding a field of pumpkins. Porters, patients, sisters, orderlies, novices, visitors, apothecaries, all were swept up by the force of her presence, to be tidied away into neat heaps wherever Mother Hildegard might decree. With that height, plus a face of an ugliness so transcendent as to be grotesquely beautiful, it was obvious why she had embraced a religious life. Christ was the only man from whom she might expect embrace in return. Her voice was deep and resonant. With its nasal Gascony accent, it bonged through the corridors of the hospital like the echo of the church bells next door. I could hear her some time before I saw her, the powerful voice increasing in volume as she came down the hall toward the office, where six ladies of the court and I huddled behind Herr Gerstmann, like island dwellers awaiting the arrival of a hurricane behind a flimsy barricade. She filled the narrow doorway with a swoosh of bat wings, and descended upon Herr Gerstmann with a cry of rapture, kissing him soundly on both cheeks.
"Mon cher ami, how unexpected a pleasure, and so much the more sweet for its unexpectedness. What brings you to me?"
Straightening, she turned a wide smile on the rest of us. The smile remained wide as Herr Gerstmann explained our mission, though a less experienced fortune-teller than I could have seen the tightening cheek muscles that turned it from a social grace to a rictus of necessity.
"We are most appreciative of your thoughts and your generosity, mesdames."
The deep, bell-like voice went on with a gracious speech of gratitude. Meanwhile, I could see the small, intelligent eyes set deep beneath bony brow ridges, darting back and forth, deciding how best to dispose of this nuisance in short order, while still extracting such money as these pious ladies might be induced to part with for the good of their souls. Having come to a decision, she clapped her hands sharply. A short nun, on the general order of Cock Robin, popped up in the doorway like a jack-in-the-box.
"Sister Angelique, be so kind as to take these ladies to the dispensary," she ordered. "Give them some suitable garments, and then show them the wards. They may assist with the distribution of food to the patients, if they are so inclined."
A slight twitch of the wide, thin mouth made it evident that Mother Hildegard didn't expect the lady's pious inclination to survive the tour of the wards. Mother Hildegard was a shrewd judge of human nature. Three of the ladies made it through the first ward, with its cases of scrofula, scabies, eczema, defluxions, and stinking pyemia, before deciding that their charitable inclinations could be entirely satisfied by a donation to L'Hôpital, and fleeing back to the dispensary to shed the rough hop-sacking gowns with which we had been furnished. In the centre of the next ward, a tall, gangly man in a dark frock coat was carrying out what appeared to be the skilful amputation of a leg, particularly skilful in that the patient was not sedated in any visible way, and was being restrained at the moment by the efforts of two husky orderlies and a solidly built nun who was sitting upon the patient's chest, her flowing draperies fortunately obscuring the man's face. One of the ladies behind me made a small gagging sound. When I looked round, all I saw was the rather wide rear aspect of two of the would-be Samaritans, jammed hip to hip in the narrow doorway, leading toward the dispensary and freedom. With a last desperate tug and the rending of silk, they burst through and fled precipitately down the dark hallway, nearly knocking over an orderly coming on the trot with a tray piled high with linens and surgical instruments. I glanced to the side and was amused to find Mary Hawkins still there. Somewhat whiter than the surgical linens, which were quite a disgraceful shade of grey, truth be told, and a bit green about the gills, but still there.
"Vite! Dépêchez-vous!"
The surgeon uttered a peremptory shout, aimed presumably at the shaken orderly, who had hastily reassembled his tray and came on the gallop to the spot where the tall, dark man was poised, bone saw in hand, ready to sever an exposed thigh bone. The orderly bent to tie a second tourniquet above the site of the operation. The saw descended with an indescribable grating sound, and I took pity on Mary Hawkins, turning her in the other direction. Her arm trembled under my hand, and the peony lips were blanched and pinched as a frost-bitten flower. "Would you like to leave?" I asked politely. "I'm sure Mother Hildegard could summon a carriage for you." I glanced over one shoulder to the vacant darkness of the hallway. I'm afraid the Comtesse and Madame Lambert have left already. Mary gulped audibly, but tightened an already firm jaw in determination.
No, she said. If you stay, I'll stay.
I definitely intended staying. Curiosity and the urge to worm my way into the operations of l'Hôpital des Anges were much too strong to weigh against any pity I might feel for Mary's sensibilities. Sister Angélique had gone some distance before noticing that we had stopped. Returning, she stood patiently waiting, a small smile on her plump face, as though expecting that we too would turn and run. I bent over a pallet at the edge of the floor. A very thin woman lay listlessly under a single blanket, her eyes drifting dully over us without interest. It wasn't the woman who had attracted my attention, so much as the oddly shaped glass vessel standing on the floor alongside her pallet. The vessel was brimming with a yellow fluid, urine, undoubtedly. I was mildly surprised. Without chemical tests or even litmus paper, what conceivable use could a urine sample be? Thinking over the various things one tested urine for, though, I had an idea. I picked up the vessel carefully, ignoring Sister Angélique's exclamation of alarmed protest. I sniffed carefully. Sure enough, half obscured by sour ammoniac fumes, the fluid smelled sickly sweet, rather like soured honey. I hesitated, but there was only one way to make sure. With a moo of distaste, I gingerly dipped the tip of one finger into the liquid and touched it delicately to my tongue. Mary, watching bug-eyed at my side, choked slightly. But Sister Angélique was watching with sudden interest. I placed a hand on the woman's forehead. It was cool, no fever to account for the wasting. "Are you thirsty, madame?" I asked the patient. I knew the answer before she spoke, seeing the empty carafe near her head.
"Always, madame," she replied, "and always hungry as well. Yet no flesh gathers on my bones, no matter how much I eat."
She raised a stick-thin arm, displaying a bony wrist, then let it fall as though the effort had exhausted her. I patted the skinny hand gently and murmured something in farewell, my exhilaration at having made a correct diagnosis substantially quenched by the knowledge that there was no possible cure for diabetes mellitus in this day. The woman before me was doomed. In subdued spirits, I rose to follow Sister Angélique, who slowed her bustling steps to walk next to me.
"Could you tell from what she suffers, madame?" the nun asked curiously. "Only from the urine?"
"Not only from that," I answered. "But yes, I know. She has... drat. What would they have called it now? She has, sugar sickness. She gets no nourishment from the food she eats, and has a tremendous thirst. Consequently, she produces large quantities of urine." Sister Angélique was nodding, a look of intense curiosity stamped on her pudgy features.
"And can you tell whether she will recover, madame?"
"No, she won't," I said bluntly. "She's far gone already. She may not last out the month."
"Ah."
The fair brows lifted, and the look of curiosity was replaced by one of respect.
"That's what Monsieur Parnell said."
"And who's he when he's at home?" I asked flippantly. The plump nun frowned in bewilderment.
"Well, at his own establishment, I believe he is a maker of trusses and a jeweller. When he comes here, though, he acts usually as a urinoscopist."
I felt my own brows rising.
"A urinoscopist?" I said unbelievingly. "There actually are such things?" "Oui, madame. And he said just what you said about the poor thin lady. I have never seen a woman who knew about the science of urinoscopy," Sister Angélique said, staring at me in frank fascination. "Well, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, sister," I said graciously.
She nodded seriously, making me feel rather ashamed of my facetiousness.
That is true, madame. Will you have a look at the gentleman in the end bed? He has a complaint of the liver, we believe.
We continued from one bed to another, making the complete circuit of the enormous hall. We saw examples of diseases I had seen only in textbooks, and every kind of traumatic injury, from head wounds inflicted in drunken brawls, to a carter whose chest had been crushed by a rolling wine barrel. I paused by some beds, asking questions of those patients who seemed able to answer. I could hear Mary breathing through her mouth behind my shoulder, but didn't check to see whether she was, in fact, holding her nose. At the conclusion of the tour, Sister Angélique turned to me with an ironic smile.
"Well, madame, do you still desire to serve the Lord by helping his unfortunates?"
I was already rolling up the sleeves of my gown.
"Bring me a basin of hot water, sister," I said, "and some soap."
"How was it, Sassenach?"
Jamie asked.
"Horrible," I answered, beaming broadly.
He raised one eyebrow, smiling down at me as I lay sprawled on the chaise.
"Oh, enjoyed yourself, did you?"
"Oh, Jamie, it was so nice to be useful again. I mopped floors and fed people gruel, and when Sister Angélique wasn't looking, I managed to change a couple of filthy dressings and lance an abscess."
"Oh, good," he said. "Did you remember to eat in the midst of all this frivolity?"
No, as a matter of fact, I didn't," I said guiltily. "On the other hand, I forgot to be sick, too." As though reminded of delinquency, the walls of my stomach took a sudden lurch inward. I pressed a fist under my breastbone. "Perhaps I should have a bite."
"Perhaps you should," he agreed,
a little grimly, reaching for the bell. He watched as I obediently downed meat pie and cheese, describing l'Hôpital des Anges and its inmates in enthusiastic detail between bites as I ate. "It's very crowded in some of the wards. Two or three to a bed, which is awful, but..." "Don't you want some of this?" I broke off to ask. "It's very good." He eyed the piece of pastry I was holding out to him.
"If you think you can keep from telling me about gangrenous toenails long enough for a bite to make it from my gullet to my stomach, then yes."
Belatedly, I noticed the slight pallor on his cheeks and the faint pinching of his nostrils. I poured a cup of wine and handed it to him before picking up my own plate again.
"And how was your day, my dear?" I asked demurely.
L'Hôpital des Anges became a refuge for me. The blunt and unsophisticated directness of nuns and patients was a wonderful refreshment from the continual chattering intrigues of the court ladies and gentlemen. I was also positive that without the relief of allowing my facial muscles to relax into their normal expression at the hôpital, my face would quickly have frozen into an expression of permanent simpering vapidity. Seeing that I appeared to know what I was doing, and required nothing of them beyond a few bandages and linens, the nuns quickly accepted my presence. And after an initial shock at my accent and title, so did the patients. Social prejudice is a strong force, but no match for simple competence when skill is in urgent demand and short supply. Mother Hildegard, busy as she was, took somewhat more time to make her own assessment of me. She never spoke to me at first, beyond a simple "Bonjour, madame," in passing, but I often felt the weight of those small, shrewd eyes boring into my back as I stooped over the bed of an elderly man with shingles, or smeared aloe ointment on the blisters of a child burned in one of the frequent house fires that beset the poorer quarters of the city. She never gave the appearance of hurrying, but covered an immense amount of ground during the day, pacing the flat grey stones of the hôpital wards with a stride that covered a yard at a time, her small white dog Bouton hurrying at her heels to keep up. A far cry from the fluffy lapdog so popular with the ladies of the court, he looked vaguely like a cross between a poodle and a dachshund, with a rough, kinky coat, whose fringes fluttered along the edges of a wide belly and stumpy, bowed legs. His feet, splay-toed and black-nailed, clicked frantically over the stones of the floor as he trotted after Mother Hildegard, pointed muzzle almost touching the sweeping black folds of her habit. "Is that a dog?" I had asked one of the orderlies in amazement when I first beheld Bouton passing through the hôpital at the heels of his mistress. He paused in his floor-sweeping to look after the curly, plumed tail disappearing into the next ward.
"Well," he said doubtfully, "Mother Hildegard says he's a dog. I wouldn't like to be the one to say he isn't."
As I became more friendly with the nuns, orderlies, and visiting physicians of the hôpital, I had various other opinions of Bouton, ranging from the tolerant to the superstitious. No one knew quite where Mother Hildegard had got him, nor why. He had been a member of the hôpital staff for several years, with a rank, in Mother Hildegard's opinion, which was the only one that counted, well above that of the nursing sisters, and equal to that of most of the visiting physicians and apothecaries. Some of the latter regarded him with suspicious aversion, others with jocular affability. One chirurgeon referred to him routinely, out of Mother's hearing, as that revolting rat, another as the smelly rabbit, and one small tubby trussmaker greeted him quite openly as Monsieur le Dishcloth. The nuns considered him something between a mascot and a totem, while the junior priest from the cathedral next door, who had been bitten in the leg when he came to administer the sacraments to the patients, confided to me his own opinion that Bouton was one of the lesser demons, disguised as a dog for his own fell purposes. In spite of the unflattering tone of the priest's remarks, I thought that he had perhaps come closest to the truth, for after several weeks of observing the pair, I had come to the conclusion that Bouton was, in fact, Mother Hildegard's familiar. She spoke to him often, not in the tone one generally uses for dogs, but as one discussing important matters with an equal. As she paused beside this bed or that, often Bouton would spring onto the mattress, nuzzling and sniffing at the startled patient. He would sit down, often on the patient's legs, bark once, and glance up inquiringly at Mother, wagging his silky plumed tail as though asking her opinion of his diagnosis, which she always gave. Though I was rather curious about this behaviour, I had had no opportunity of closely observing the odd pair at work, until one dark, rainy morning in March. I was standing by the bed of a middle-aged carter, making casual conversation with him, while I tried to figure out what in bloody hell was wrong with the man. It was a case that had come in the week before. He had had his lower leg caught in the wheel of a cart when he carelessly dismounted before the vehicle had stopped moving. It was a compound fracture, but a fairly uncomplicated one. I had reset the bone, and the wound seemed to be healing nicely. The tissue was a healthy pink, with good granulation, no bad smell, no telltale red streaks, no extreme tenderness, nothing at all to explain why the man still smouldered with fever and produced the dark, odorous urine of a lingering infection.
"Bonjour, madame,"
the deep, rich voice spoke above me, and I glanced up at the towering form of Mother Hildegard. There was a whoosh past my elbow, and Bouton landed on the mattress with a thump that made the patient groan slightly.
"What do you think?" said Mother Hildegard.
I wasn't at all sure whether she was addressing me or Bouton, but took the benefit of the doubt and explained my observations. "So there must be a secondary source of infection," I concluded, "but I can't find it. I'm wondering now whether perhaps he has an internal infection that's not related to the leg wound. A mild appendicitis or a bladder infection, perhaps, though I don't find any abdominal tenderness either." Mother Hildegard nodded.
"A possibility, certainly. Bouton."
The dog cocked his head towards his mistress, who jerked an oblong chin in the direction of the patient.
"À la bouche, Bouton,"
she ordered. With a mincing step, the dog pushed the round black nose that presumably gave him his name into the carter's face. The man's eyes, heavy-lidded with fever, sprang open at this intrusion, but a glance at the imposing presence of Mother Hildegard stopped whatever complaint he might have been forming.
"Open your mouth," Mother Hildegard instructed,
and such was her force of character that he did so, even though his lips twitched at the nearness of boutons. Dog kissing, plainly, wasn't on his agenda of desirable activities.
"No," said Mother Hildegard thoughtfully, watching Bouton. "That isn't it. Have a look elsewhere, Bouton, but carefully. The man has a broken leg, remember."
As though he had in fact understood every word, the dog began to sniff curiously at the patient, nosing into his armpits, putting stubby feet on his chest in order to investigate, nudging gently along the crease of the groin. When it came to the injured leg, he stepped carefully over the limb before putting his nose to the surface of the bandages round it. He returned to the groin area.
"Well, what else?" I thought impatiently. "He's a dog, after all."
Nudged at the top of the thigh, then sat down and barked once, wagging triumphantly.
"There it is," said Mother Hildegard, pointing to a small brown scab just below the inguinal crease.
"But that's almost healed," I protested. "It isn't infected."
"No."
The tall nun placed a hand on the man's thigh and pressed hard. Her muscular fingers dented the pale, clammy flesh, and the carter screamed like a banshee.
"Ah," she said in satisfaction, observing the deep prints left by her touch. "A pocket of putrefaction."
It was. The scab had loosened at one edge, and a thick ooze of yellow pus showed under it. A little probing, with Mother Hildegard holding the man by leg and shoulder, revealed the problem. A long sliver of wood, flying free of the splintered cartwheel, had driven upward deep into the thigh. Disregarded because of the apparently insignificant entrance wound, it had gone unnoticed by the patient himself, to whom the whole leg was one giant pain. While the tiny entrance wound had healed cleanly, the deeper wound had festered and formed a pocket of pus around the intrusion, buried in the muscle tissue, where no surface symptoms were visible, to human senses at least. A little scalpel work to enlarge the entrance wound, a quick grip with a pair of long-nosed forceps, a smooth, forceful pull, and I held up a 3-inch sliver of wood coated with blood and slime.
"Not bad, Bouton," I said, with a nod of acknowledgement.
A long pink tongue lolled happily, and the black nostrils sniffed in my direction.
"Yes, she's a good one," said Mother Hildegard,
and this time there was no doubt which of us she was speaking to, Bouton being male. Bouton leaned forward and sniffed politely at my hand, then licked my knuckles once in reciprocal acknowledgement of a fellow professional. I repressed the urge to wipe my hand on my gown. "Amazing," I said, meaning it.
"Yes,"
said Mother Hildegard casually, but with an unmistakable note of pride.
"He's very good at locating tumours beneath the skin as well, and while I cannot always tell what he finds in the odours of breath and urine, he has a certain tone of bark that indicates unmistakably the presence of a derangement of the stomach."
Under the circumstances, I saw no reason to doubt it. I bowed to Bouton and picked up a vial of powdered St. John's wort to dress the infection.
"Pleased to have your assistance, Bouton. You can work with me any time."
"Very sensible of you," said Mother Hildegard with a flash of strong teeth. "Many of the physicians and chirurgiens who work here are less inclined to take advantage of his skills."
"Ah, well." I didn't want to disparage anyone's reputation, but my glance across the hall at Monsieur Voleroux must have been transparent. Mother Hildegard laughed.
"Well, we take what God sends us. though occasionally I wonder whether he sends them to us only in order to keep them out of greater trouble elsewhere. Still, the bulk of our physicians are better than nothing, even if only marginally so. You,
and the teeth flashed once more, reminding me of a genial draught horse,
are a great deal better than nothing, madame.
Thanks.
I have wondered, though, Mother Hildegard went on, watching as I applied the medicated dressing, why you see only the patients with wounds and broken bones. You avoid those with spots and coughs and fevers, yet it is more common for les maîtresses to deal with such things. I don't think I have ever seen a female chirurgien before.
Les maîtresses were the unlicensed healers, mostly from the provinces, who dealt in herbals, poultices, and charms. Les maîtresses sages-femmes were the midwives, the top of the heap so far as popular healers were concerned. Many were accorded more respect than the licensed practitioners, and were much preferred by the lower-class patients, as they were likely to be both more capable and much less expensive. I wasn't surprised that she had observed my proclivities. I had gathered long since that very little about her hôpital escaped Mother Hildegard's notice. "It isn't lack of interest," I assured her. "It's only that I'm with child, so I can't expose myself to anything contagious for the child's sake. Broken bones aren't catching."
"Sometimes I wonder," said Mother Hildegard, with a glance at an incoming stretcher. "We're having a plague of them this week. No, don't go."
She motioned me back.
"Sister Cecile will see to it. She'll call you if there's need."
The nun's small grey eyes regarded me with curiosity, mingled with appraisal.
"So, you are not only a milady, you are with child, but your husband does not object to your coming here. He must be a most unusual man."
"Well, he's Scottish," I said, by way of explanation, not wishing to go into the subject of my husband's objections.
"Oh, Scottish," Mother Hildegard nodded understandingly. "Just so."
The bed trembled against my thigh as Bouton leapt off and trotted toward the door.
"He smells a stranger," Mother Hildegard remarked. "Bouton assists the doorkeeper as well as the physicians, with no more gratitude for his efforts, I fear."
The sounds of peremptory barks and a high voice raised in terror came through the double doors of the entryway.
"Oh, it's Father Balmont again. Curse the man! Can't he learn to stand still and let Bouton smell him?"
Mother Hildegard turned in haste to the succour of her companion, turning back at the last moment to smile engagingly at me.
"Perhaps I will send him to assist you with your tasks, madame, while I soothe Father Balmont. While no doubt a most holy man, he lacks true appreciation for the work of an artist."
She strode toward the doors with her long, unhurried stride, and with a last word for the carter, I turned to Sister Cecile and the latest stretcher case. Jamie was lying on the carpet in the sitting room when I came back to the house, with a small boy sitting cross-legged on the floor beside him. Jamie was holding a bilboquet in one hand, and had the other poised over one eye.
"Of course I can," he was saying, "any day and twice on Sundays. Watch!"
Placing the hand over his eye, he fixed the other piercingly on the bilboquet and gave the ivory cup a toss. The tethered ball leapt from its socket into an arc and dropped, as though guided by radar, landing back in its cup with a snug little plop.
"See?"
he said, removing the hand from his eye. He sat up and handed the cup to the boy.
"Here, you try it."
He grinned at me and slid a hand under the hem of my skirt, clasping my green silk ankle in greeting.
"Having fun?" I inquired. "Not yet," he replied, giving the ankle a squeeze. "I was waiting for you, Sassenach."
The long, warm fingers curled around my ankle, slid higher, playfully stroking the curve of my calf, as a pair of limpid blue eyes gazed up at me, all innocence. His face had a streak of dried mud down one side, and there were dirty blotches on his shirt and kilt.
"Is that so?" I said, trying to pull my leg free of his grasp inconspicuously. "I should have thought your little playmate would have been all the company you needed."
The boy, understanding none of the English in which these exchanges were conducted, ignored them, intent on trying to work the bilboquet with one eye closed. The first two attempts having failed, he opened the second eye and glared at the toy, as though daring it not to work. The second eye closed again, but not all the way. A small slit remained, gleaming alertly below the thick fringe of dark lashes. Jamie clicked his tongue disapprovingly, and the eye hastily snapped tight shut.
"Now then, Fergus, we'll have nae cheating, if you please," he said. "Fair's fair."
The boy obviously caught the meaning, if not the words. He grinned sheepishly, displaying a pair of large, white, gleamingly perfect front teeth, square as a squirrel's. Jamie's hand exerted an invisible pull, obliging me to move closer to him to avoid being toppled off my Moroccan heels.
"Ah," he said. "Well, Fergus here is a man of many talents, and a boon companion for the idle hours when a man's wife has deserted him and left him to seek his own pursuits amidst the wickedness of the city."
The long fingers curled delicately into the hollow behind my knee, tickling suggestively.
"But he isn't qualified as a partner for the pastime I had in mind."
"Fergus," I said, eyeing the boy and trying to ignore the goings-on below. The lad was possibly 9 or 10, but small for his age, and fine-boned as a ferret. Clad in clean, worn clothes, several sizes too big for him, he was also as French as they come, with a pale, sallow skin and big, dark eyes of a Parisian street child.
"Well, his name is really Claudel, but we decided that didn't sound very manly, so he's to be called Fergus instead. A suitable warrior's name, that."
Catching the sound of his name, or names, the boy glanced up and grinned shyly at me.
"This is Madame," Jamie explained to the boy, gesturing to me with his free hand. "You may call her Milady." "I did not think he could manage Broch Turach," he added to me, "or even Fraser, for that matter."
"Milady will be fine," I said, smiling. I wriggled my leg harder, trying to shake off the leech-like grip.
Why, if I may ask?"
"Why what? Oh, why Fergus, you mean?"
"That's what I mean, all right."
I wasn't sure just how far his arm would reach, but the hand was creeping slowly up the back of my thigh.
"Jamie, take your hand away this minute."
The fingers darted to one side and deftly pulled loose the ribbon garter that held up my stocking. The stocking slithered down my leg to puddle round my ankle.
"You beast!"
I kicked at him, but he dodged aside, laughing.
"Oh, beast, is it? What kind?"
"A cur,"
I snapped, trying to bend over to pull up my stocking without falling off my heels. The child Fergus, after a brief incurious glance at us, had resumed his trials with the bilboquet.
"As for the lad," he continued blithely, "Fergus is now in my employ."
"To do what?" I asked. "We already have a boy who cleans the knives and boots and a stable lad."
Jamie nodded.
"Aye, that's true. We have not got a pickpocket, though. Or rather, we hadn't. We have now."
I drew in my breath and blew it out again slowly.
"I see.
I suppose it would be dense of me to ask exactly why we need to add a pickpocket to the household."
"To steal letters, Sassenach,"
Jamie said calmly.
"Oh,"
I said, light beginning to dawn.
"I cannae get anything sensible out of his highness. When he's with me, he will not do anything but moan about Louise de la Tour, or grind his teeth and curse because they've been quarrelling again. In either case, all he wants to do is to get drunk as quickly as possible. Ma is losing all patience with him, for he's haughty and sullen by turns,
and I canna get anything out of Sheridan.
The Earl of Mar was the most respected of the exiled Scottish Jacobites in Paris. A man whose long and illustrious prime was only now beginning to edge into elderliness, he had been the primary supporter of King James at the abortive rising in 1715, and had followed his king into exile after the defeat at Sheriffmuir. I had met the Earl, and liked him. An elderly, courtly man, with a personality as straight as his backbone. He was now doing his best, with little reward, it seemed, for his lord's son. I had met Thomas Sheridan, too, the prince's tutor, an elderly man who handled His Highness's correspondence, translating impatience and illiteracy into courtly French and English. I sat down and pulled my stocking back up. Fergus, apparently hardened to the sight of female limbs, ignored me altogether, concentrating grimly on the bilboquet.
"Letters, Sassnach," he said. "I need the letters. Letters from Rome sealed with a Stuart crest. Letters from France. Letters from England. Letters from Spain. We can get them either from the prince's house. Fergus can go with me as a page, or possibly from the people messenger who brings them. That would be a bit better, as we'd have the information in advance." "So, we've made the bargain," Jamie said, nodding at his new servant. "Fergus will do his best to get what I need, and I will provide him with clothes and lodging and 30 écus a year. If he's caught while doing my service, I'll do my best to buy him off. If it cannot be done, and he loses a hand or an ear, then I maintain him for the rest of his life, as he will not be able to pursue his profession. And if he's hanged, then I guarantee to have masses said for his soul for the space of a year. I think that's fair, no?"
I felt a cold hand pass down my spine.
"Jesus Christ, Jamie," was all I could find to say.
He shook his head and reached out a hand for the bilboquet.
"Not our Lord, Sassnach. Pray to St. Dismas, the patron saint of thieves and traitors."
Jamie reached over and took the bilboquet from the boy. He flicked his wrist sharply, and the ivory ball rose in a perfect parabola to descend into its cup with an inevitable plop.
"I see," I said.
I eyed the new employee with interest as he took the toy Jamie offered him and started in on it at once more, dark eyes gleaming with concentration.
"Where did you get him?" I asked curiously. "I found him in a brothel."
"Oh, of course," I said. "To be sure." I eyed the dirt and smears on his clothes.
"Which you were visiting for some really excellent reason, I expect."
"Oh, aye," he said. He sat back, arms wrapped about his knees, grinning as he watched me make repairs to my garter.
"I thought you'd prefer me to be found in such an establishment to the alternative of being found in a dark alleyway with my head bashed in."
I saw the boy Fergus's eyes focus at a spot somewhat past the bilboquet, where a tray of iced cakes stood on a table near the wall. A small, pointed pink tongue darted out across his lower lip.
"I think your protégé is hungry," I said. "Why don't you feed him, and then you can tell me just what in bloody hell happened this afternoon." "Well, I was on my way to the docks," he began, obediently rising to his feet, "and just past the Rue Eglantine, I began to have a queer feeling up the back of my neck."
Jamie Fraser had spent 2 years in the army of France, fought and stolen with a gang of Scottish broken men, and been hunted as an outlaw through the moors and mountains of his native land, all of which had left him with an extreme sensitivity to the sensation of being followed. He couldn't have said whether it was the sound of a footfall too close behind, or the sight of a shadow that shouldn't be there, or something less tangible, the scent of evil on the air, perhaps. But he had learned that the prickle of warning among the short hairs of his neck was something to be ignored at his peril. Promptly obeying the dictates of his cervical vertebrae, he turned left instead of right at the next corner, ducked around a whelk seller's stall, cut between a barrow filled with steamed puddings and another of fresh vegetable marrows, and into a small charcuterie. Pressed against the